From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Jonathan Mahler is my guest. He is a writer for the New York Times Magazine and is the author of several books. His newest is The Gods of New York, Egotists, Idealists, Opportunists, and the Birth of the Modern City, 1986 to 1990. Jonathan Mahler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the subject of your book, I want to kind of marvel at the artistry of it. It's really incredibly written, and as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, how does he do this? I mean, it's kind of like a movie. It's kind of a nonfiction bonfire of the vanities, if you will. That is, there's many characters, and we go back and forth. How did you map it out? Did you have a wall with lines, or what?
Yeah, I mean, that was the challenge. I wanted to do a few things that are kind of hard to do, at the same time. So one was, I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted it to be character driven, but I didn't want it to be driven by a single character. I wanted a kind of large cast of characters because I'm trying to capture this moment in the history of the life of New York and in some ways in America. And so, to do that, I felt like I needed more than one or two or even three characters, big characters. So, that was sort of the ongoing job as I kind of researched and wrote and rewrote, was figuring out how, what was the right balance of each character, how many I actually had room for, how to make sure that each one has, kind of starts the book in one place and ends in another, that each one is on, his or her own kind of journey. That's really, maybe above all why this book took me so many years to write, kind of getting all that right, figuring that balance out.
How many years?
What's the biggest challenge? Yeah. Well, it was 8 years from when I kind of signed the contract when the book was published. So, probably 7 years of work.
Being a mature adult, I like to make Legos. And one thing about your Lego is when it's done, you put the final piece on and there it is.
Yeah.
My wife is a painter, and I always wonder, how does she know when her painting is done? She stands in front of it and she stares at it, and then all of a sudden, it's over.
Yeah.
So which one is this? Is it a Lego or a painting? How did you know when you were done?
Yeah, I mean, good question. The book had a kind of a natural ending, which is, it begins with Ed Koch's inauguration in 1986 when he's kind of on top of the world. And it ends when he is basically, loses his last effort to get reelected and is basically kicked out of Gracie Mansion at the end of 1989, the beginning of 1990. So there was I could see where the book would start and finish. Knowing when the book was ready and done, was I would say probably more like a painting. I mean, you can, especially with a book like this, with so many characters, and so much happening, you can sort of tinker endlessly with it. So I think at a certain point, my editor, sort of decided like we were close and it was time to schedule the book. And once the book is scheduled, there's not much you can do. You got to turn it in. So.
Oh yeah, I think
it's like if a collector buys your painting, right?
That's right. I think a painter might look at that painting when they see it on the wall and think, "Oh, I should touch this up." But I guess you can't do that now that it's in print. You're done.
I have the same feeling. I look at the book now and think, "Oh, if I could do it again, I might do a few things differently." I'm not unhappy with it, but yeah.
Do you labor over each sentence, or how does that work? Or do you go a first draft, a third draft?
I tend to be more of a I do have a hard time leaving writing on the page that I'm not happy with. So for me, the first draft, and this is true of my magazine stories too, is always really a struggle because I just have a hard time not kind of tinkering endlessly with paragraphs, which isn't to say that I don't end up doing a lot of revision too. But for me, the hardest part is getting a first draft down. With a book like this, you know, there was no question that I was going to have to do a lot of revising because I was trying to cover so many events, and I had so many different characters, it was just tinkering with that balance was just, I knew was going to be kind of an endless project, and it really was. Yeah.
Well, Jonathan Mahler, how did you come up with the years? I mean, New York's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And you focused on this particular period, 1986 to 1990, and you were just saying, you know, that was the Koch era, but how did you decide that this was the story that you wanted to tell? And if I can add to that question, why is it the birth of the modern city?
Yeah, sure. So what happened is I began, really this book grew out of my work at the New York Times. So in 2016, I'm generally a writer for the magazine at the Times. I write for the Sunday magazine. But in 2016, they moved me to the campaign, the presidential campaign, just, you know, for a little over a year. And I was supposed to do kind of longer stories about the candidates. And I gravitated toward Donald Trump, who was running for president then for the first time, and some of his early New York years, so the 1980s. So I started really looking at that period of time, mostly, you know, with Trump in mind. And then, an editor friend at Random House suggested I do a book about kind of Trump's origin story, which I did not want to do. But by then, I had spent enough time immersed in the 80s in New York that I felt like, wow, this is actually a really interesting period of time. And what kind of really captured my imagination about those years was, you know, both the kind of size of the characters, just these kind of outsized figures like Ed Koch, like Donald Trump, like Al Sharpton, like Rudy Giuliani, Spike Lee, all these big, big New York characters who we don't really have anymore. So it was one thing. All these events, there were so much happened during these years, you know, these kind of infamous racial incidents like Howard Beach and Tawana Brawley and the Central Park Five. But also these were the years of the AIDS crisis and the birth of ACT UP. And these were the years of the crack epidemic and sort of soaring crime in New York City when it was, you know, crime was reaching historic levels that it had never seen before and has never seen since. So there was just a kind of a lot happening. And then kind of finally, in answering your second question, I also came to see these years as sort of transformative for New York. And what I mean by that is if you kind of wind the history of New York back a little further into the 1940s and 50s, you know, New York was a very different place then. It was a real working class city. It was a city of shipping, of manufacturing, of powerful labor unions, labor bosses. It was a city where you know, people could find good, steady paying jobs. People who were willing to work could find jobs. And then that all kind of got hollowed out over the course of the 1960s and 70s, as it did in you know, cities across America because of deindustrialization. And New York's economy kind of vanished. And in the 1980s, it was reborn. And it was reborn really as the city of Wall Street, as the city of finance, as the city of real estate. And that is the city we still live in today. So what I mean really by the birth of the modern city is that that is when New York kind of made the choice to become, to sort of reorient its economy around Wall Street and finance and real estate. And, to in some ways abandon its history as the great working class city and become a very different kind of place. And to me, that's the modern city. That's New York. That's New York we live in today, as we see in our, it's become a subject of a lot of debate in the ongoing mayoral race here.
Yes, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Yes, I want to get your opinion on that. But I guess one of the byproducts of that is the end of Greenwich Village. I mean, Greenwich Village is still there geographically, but it's not what it had been for like 500 years, right?
Yeah. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think the city has, what happened really is, you know, money took over, and it took over a lot of neighborhoods. I mean, it's, you know, the term for it is sort of gentrification, which doesn't quite kind of capture the process, in all of its kind of complexity. Because the, you know, rediscovery of neighborhoods and the rebuilding of apartment buildings and the growth of new businesses, of course, was in many ways kind of good for the city. The economy needed it. Those are tax revenues for New York to provide services and, to, you know, kind of, maintain and build its infrastructure. But, you know, what happens when large sums of money and investment start to pour into neighborhoods is that the characters of the neighborhoods change. And that is, you know, really not only does the population change and the demographic of the neighborhood change, but so does the character of the neighborhood. And I mean, what happens in the process is, in many ways, everything gets sort of flattened out. A lot of the character of the city, a lot of the things that made particular neighborhoods unique, disappear in favor of, kind of bigger, either chain stores or, very fancy restaurants, with celebrity chefs and bookstores, independent bookstores disappear. And the life of the neighborhood, the street life of the neighborhood is kind of, you know, ineradicably changed.
I used to love St. Mark's Place, starting there with the gem spa and getting an egg cream and then walking down and going to the comic shop and Kim's Video and all those places.
Oh, yeah.
All gone. After a long period of time. Now it's not a distinct street at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tricky thing. It's sad and in some ways tragic when these neighborhoods kind of disappear. But at the same time, I mean, cities and New York in particular has to evolve. The city has to change and, it has to, find ways to kind of reinvent itself to adapt to the changing economy and the changing population. And, you know, it's unfortunate that I think that, you know, that New York, has not managed and, you know, by which I mean really the city government has not managed the sort of transformation of the city, as well as it could have. But, you know, in some ways, the city is a better place. I mean, the waterfront has been rebuilt and, you know, there's more parkland on the water and more, you know, nice public spaces that are all free. So, you know, it's a little bit of a, I guess I would say a mixed blessing.
Yeah. I guess with every good thing you get something equally bad.
Yes.
Definitely true. You kind of alluded to this earlier, but after I was done with your book, I was thinking, you know, kind of like a looking into the whatever happened to this person or that person. Yeah. And I was totally surprised to find out that one of your subjects, this guy, Donald Trump, turned out
have
a political
right?
career. I mean, this, although you didn't want to write the origin story of Donald Trump.
I sort of
you
did.
Yeah, you definitely did.
Yeah.
And if a person were reading this without knowing, they would be completely, or even knowing, it's a shocking turn of events with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But you can really see all of the things that people who don't like Donald Trump, like me, you can see all of the things, the affinity for gold leaf, I mean, how could a person, it made me think, I wonder if I could get a loan of several billion dollars without having to put out any money to buy a thing.
Yeah.
And then abandon it without having to pay back anybody, anything. How does that work?
Yeah. Well, once you get the banks on the hook, I mean, you know, there was so much, he did such a good job of promoting himself that banks were so eager to be in business with him that, you know, that they all were willing to invest in his, you know, casino scheme in Atlantic City which was clear to pretty much every analyst on Wall Street that it was going to be a disaster. But, you know, there was enough, he generated enough excitement about you know, the business of Donald Trump that he was able to basically con banks into lending him money. And then once they're on the hook, I mean, you know, he's as goes Donald Trump, so go these banks. So, you know, they could only do so much at that point. Yeah, I think, you know, another, it's just getting back to the idea of Donald Trump's origin story. I mean, I think what you really see during these years, and it's you know, partly a story of the New York City tabloids during these years, but you really see how and when Donald Trump learned to command the public's attention, learned that the whole game here, the way you amass power and influence in the world, is to capture the public's attention and hold on to it and sort of tell them stories, build storylines around yourself. And he recognized that it didn't matter really whether half the city thought he was a con artist and you know, 25% of the city admired him and 25% of the city wasn't sure what to think. The point was everyone was kind of talking about him and everyone was interested in Donald Trump. And I think you also see during these years where he, you know, he was a product of the tabloids, and the tabloids are very, they see the world in black and white, in heroes and villains. That is, you know, they're sort of like comic books for adults. And Donald Trump that is his lens on the world, right? We see him. You are a good guy, or you are a bad guy. You are with him or you are against him. And if you are with him, you are by definition a good guy. So if you're George Santos, it doesn't matter what you've done. If you like Donald Trump, you know, he's gonna take care of you. So you see this sort of attitude that's really forged in the tabloids of 1980s New York. That is, you know, that there are just, you know, two kinds of people in the world: the people who are with you and the people who are against you.
Well, I want to talk about the tabloids a little bit. So, in the kind of turn of the century, New York, up until the '60s, there were, I don't know how many newspapers were in New York, but lots of them.
And more, well over a dozen.
And they published twice a day, plus extras and all those things.
Yeah.
And then when did the tabloids kind of come along, and then what happened to them? I mean, they're still there, I guess, but.
Yeah. I mean, what happened was, you know, New York had more than a dozen newspapers. There were papers in there were morning papers, there were afternoon papers, there were evening papers. I mean, there were newspapers being published basically all day and being sold on the streets all the time. Gradually, you know, with the birth of kind of modern radio and television, the newspapers started to disappear. And by the time my book takes place, 1986, there are really just four newspapers left in New York. And there's the New York Times, there's the Daily News, there's the New York Post, and there's Newsday. And so, you know, kind of somewhat paradoxically, because they were the only newspapers left, they had a kind of outsized influence over the city, because this was still a newspaper town. This was before the internet. This was really before cable news. These papers, everyone still read these newspapers. Everyone still read newspapers, and these were the newspapers to read because they were the only ones left. So, you know, they were incredibly influential. You know, to a degree now that I think is almost hard to imagine, because we don't really have anything like it in our modern media ecosystem. Everyone is, you know, our attention is so fragmented now. There are so many different media sources. This was a very different moment. You know, what happened to them is they were, you know, in some ways at the kind of peak of their power in the 1980s, and they were redefining celebrity culture in America. You know, they were covering crime and corruption, and you know, they had sort of big famous columnists like Jimmy Breslin, and you know, and then along, not so many years later, comes you know, first lots of cable news, and then the internet, and And, you know, you get on the subway now and, but, you know, back in the 80s, you get on the subway and literally everyone on the subway is reading a newspaper. Now you get on the subway and everyone's looking at their phone. I mean, that's what happened.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you used to be able to get on the subway and you didn't have to buy the tabloid. You would just look at the people around you and you would see what exactly happened that day.
Yeah.
And the headlines would give you like a daily thing. I remember that there was a woman who was pushed in front of the subway and her hand was been cut off and she was a musician. And each day they had something about her on the tabloid headline, hand sewn back on, all these things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You just follow it like a soap opera, but without actually having to buy the paper because everybody had it.
Yeah. or you could spend 35 cents and buy one.
Yeah, you could. Oh, but why? They're all over the place.
Yeah.
It's an interesting change, I think, in the world that we don't use newspapers anymore after all this time. We're talking with Jonathan Mahler, and his new book is called The Gods of New York, Egotists, Idealists, Opportunists, and the Birth of the Modern City, 1986 to 1990. And it's the story of a lot of different interesting people. I have a question about Spike Lee, who made his film Do the Right Thing during this period and that you talk about in your book. And you talk about him going to the studio and them having a hard time with the ending of the movie. And my question is this. Was the studio's objection to the ending of Do the Right Thing a political objection or a dramatic objection? I mean, I think when I saw Do the Right Thing, I thought, I don't like this ending. And I didn't dislike it because of violence or whatever. I just didn't think the ending worked dramatically.
Hmm. I think they objected to it because they thought it was too incendiary. They thought it was too provocative in a sense. The idea that this movie would build toward this climactic moment when the police, choke to death, one of the, you know, kind of main figures in the movie, Radia Rahim, and that, you know, touches off, the torching of the pizzeria and then a massive riot in the streets. I think they felt that it was just, it was too violent. It was too provocative. It was too inflammatory. And so they wanted him to tone it down. So I think it was less a dramatic. I mean, I don't know if it was quite a political objection, but I think it was a concern about how it was going to be received with that ending. And you know, I think they anticipated what a lot of critics would come to say when the movie was released, which is that this ending is going to cause rioting.
When you were during your research, were you relying on written accounts or did you interview people? Did you talk to Spike Lee about this?
I did talk to Spike Lee. Yeah. I did both. Over the course of all those years, and you know, I'm a journalist, so my instinct is always to talk to everyone. So I talked to more than 200 people for the book, really everyone who was around then who was willing to talk to me, I talked to. And then beyond that, I relied a lot on kind of archival material and on the kind of contemporaneous newspaper and reports and things like the Village Voice and Spy Magazine, all sorts of other kind of publications that were around then that no longer exist. Yeah.
Is the Village Voice no longer exist?
The Village Voice no longer exists now.
That's a shame. That was a great paper.
Great paper.
Well, yeah. I know Donald Trump wouldn't care about this, but I'm sure you do. Did you do some fact checking?
I did. I hired two fact checkers actually. They kind of combed through the book and, you know, pointed out every little inaccuracy. And I, you know, it took me that process took months. Yeah.
I can imagine. I mean, I know when I'm reading a nonfiction book, which I read all the time, if I see a mistake, which I do, I didn't find it in yours, but when I see one, then I suspect the entire book because if I saw this thing, well, then what about the rest of it? two different fact checkers? Did they work together or they work separately, or how does that work?
They worked separately. They divided the book in half and all kind of alternated chapters, or, you know, one took like some of the characters and the other took other characters. And yeah. And one is a New Yorker fact checker and one is a, you know, just a young researcher who is terrific. And it was, you know, not only did it take them, you know, months to do the job, then for me to kind of go back over all their notes took many weeks too. So yeah, much longer than I had anticipated.
Is that an expense for you or for Random House?
That's an expense for me. I paid for that out of my own pocket. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Well, that's devotion.
The problem is that I do this, you know, I work at the magazine at the Times, and I'm so, they fact check all my stories. And I've come to see that it's really critical because I'm, you know, I'm very careful, as careful as I can be. And I think I'm very conscientious, but you still just, you know, you're going to make mistakes when you write a book that's 135,000 words, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When you're writing for the magazine, for the New York Times Magazine, or when you're covering the elections, then you're writing and submitting and printing, you know, within a matter of days. Whereas here you've taken 8 years between writing and printing. So, how do you approach writing differently when you're writing a current event or when you're writing a book like this? Because I know you've written other books too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm more often than not, the stories I'm writing at the Times are kind of long magazine stories, which are not 8 year projects, but they are, you know, they can be, you know, 4 month projects.
Yeah.
So they're kind of, much shorter versions of this. You know, it's in some ways it's a kind of a condensed version of writing a book with a magazine story. You know, you spend several weeks, sometimes a couple months, just doing research, talking to as many people as you can, going places to see things and people, reading everything that's been written about any of the subjects in your story. You know, and then you get to a point where you have a deadline, you have to start writing. And then from that, you know, you get a first draft down, and that's the first draft is always very rough, and you revise it. And it's really kind of the same thing, you know, as I did with the book. It just, you know, happens over a much shorter period of time. Though there are cases when I do stories at the Times that are shorter and on a much faster turnaround, can be, you know, sometimes it can be a matter of days, as you say. I like to avoid those stories whenever possible, but sometimes they can't be avoided. Yeah.
Well, how did you get started in journalism? Where did you study? Did studying help you?
It did not. I went to Northwestern, and I did not study journalism there. I just studied English literature, though I did my senior year start working for the paper. And really that was it. I started working for the paper. I wrote like rock music reviews, and I wrote, you know, some like kind of arts, mostly arts, like profiles and pieces. And I enjoyed it. And I thought, I thought I was, you know, good enough at it to give it a try. I sort of didn't think it would work, honestly. It seemed kind of far-fetched, this idea that I would, you know, graduate from college and start working in journalism and actually make a living doing it, particularly because Northwestern had this whole big journalism school, Medill, sort of famous journalism school, filled with you know, ambitious journalists who were, I assumed, had much more experience than I did by the time they graduated. You know, I was hoping to live in New York, or in a, you know, ideally New York, but in a city that was going to be expensive to live in, tough place to be a journalist where you don't make a ton of money. So I kind of started thinking, well, I'm going to give this a try and, you know, I'll pivot if it doesn't work out. And then, you know, one job just kind of led to another. And then eventually, you know, I migrated from, you know, newspapers to magazines, because deeper I got into it, the more I felt like I wanted to write longer stories. And then I, you know, felt like I really wanted to write a book. So I sold my first book, which was, you know, back when I was in my kind of late 20s. And, And I just, you know, by that point, it was like too late to turn back. I was like, I'm not going to go back to graduate school and try to do something else now. So, and it was working out. So, you know, I think the question, and, you know, I've had a great career. I love it. I guess the question now is a lot of like young journalists or aspiring journalists, I should say, often call me now and, you know, often they're daughters or sons of friends, or friends' friends. And, you know, I'm always happy to talk to them, but it's sort of, you know, it's a much harder business now to get started in there. And there aren't the same kind of, you know, there used to be sort of prescribed routes. You know, you kind of move from a smaller paper to a medium sized paper to a bigger paper. You know, now there aren't very many small or medium or even large papers left. So you have to kind of figure out a new kind of make your own path, essentially.
Do you, you work at the New York Times. Do you go to the New York Times or do you just work at home?
I do. Yeah. I don't go every day. I go, I don't know, a couple times a week. Yeah.
And what's it like there?
I mean, I love it there. I find it's a hard place to work, but it's a fun place to go. Cause it's just, you know, it's, there's so many journalists there, so many people to chat with. It's hard to get anything done. But it's, you know, it's a beautiful building. It's not in the best neighborhood. It's right across the street from Port Authority, but the building itself is amazing. And it's, you know, I love the institution. I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but I think it's like, you know, an important, great institution. I love being part of it. And I love the feel of being in the office. It's like, it's a cool place. It's filled with really smart, interesting people.
Does it still look anything like it looked in the movies? You know, is there a city room?
No, it's very, it doesn't look like that anymore. I mean, it used to, it's just, you know, and there's still a kind of a main bullpen area in the newsroom. On the third floor of the building, but it's not, you know, it's definitely not what it used to be. It's mostly just kind of like cubicles now. And, you know, no one's banging away on a typewriter and no one's smoking cigarettes and, you know, those days are over. I do love those. I'm a sucker for any of those old newspaper movies. I will watch them anytime.
You know, I kind of miss the old Times Square. Like Times Square has been all cleaned up. It's like Disneyland.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I miss the old.
Yeah. It's part of that, you know, part of that transformation of the city. It's no one goes to Times Square now except tourists. I mean, that's it. Yeah.
Unless you want to go to a show. But I mean, most people who go to shows are tourists too, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesse Green and tourists.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I was talking to Jesse Green here on the show not too long ago. And
oh, cool.
It's kind of interesting that the one thing that the newspaper and a theater critic have defied the tides of change, because, you know, a book like yours, I saw that New Yorker had chosen it as something of note.
Yeah.
The most recent issue. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a good review of a book is important, but at the same time, everybody is a critic and people can write about it on Amazon or whatever. And a book critic's job is less than it was, and same with a movie critic. But a theater critic still costs a few hundred dollars to go to the theater, so people still care about theater criticism. And possibly rock and roll criticism, but not as much, I don't think.
Yeah, I think not as much. And also, with theater, there are so few theater critics left that, you know, the ones who are there have a lot of power.
Yeah, they can make or break a show, I think.
Yeah.
But so what I'm wondering is, does everybody do it out of their office at home and they just come in to chat when they go to the Times?
At the Times? No, I mean, I most people are in – because I'm at the magazine, it's a little – the rules are a little different. So, you know, the staff writers at the magazine, there's kind of a group of us and, you know, a group of us in New York and then some others kind of scattered around the country and the world. And people, you know, tend to only – we go in less frequently than the kind of regular reporters at the newspaper. But, you know, there's also a kind of assumption that, you know, you're going to be spending a lot of your time out reporting anyway. So, you know, the newsroom itself is, you know, it's more like a, it's a place where editors have to be all the time and reporters kind of come and go.
In your book, Jonathan Mahler, The Gods of New York, activism is a real, plays a real role. Yeah. And I think in the history of New York and in the history of America, activism has played a role. I mean, in New York, there was the period of Robert Moses, and he was, you know, just plowing down everything until finally they said, wait a minute, no, you're not putting a highway that cuts through here. And they won, right?
Yeah.
Or you mentioned Port Authority. That was when they, was it Port Authority that they lost? No, it was the other Pennsylvania station. There was a beautiful Pennsylvania station, and they and there was activism, and Jackie Kennedy was involved trying to keep it from being torn down, and then they tore it down anyway.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a message about activism to draw from your book.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I, you know, two of the main characters in the book are Al Sharpton and Larry Kramer, who starts ACT UP during these years. And, you know, these are the years where Al Sharpton really becomes, you know, a civil rights activist in New York, an unusual civil rights activist, certainly. But he was a civil rights activist. And yeah, I mean, I think that there's no question that ACT UP, which Larry Kramer starts during these years, really in many ways kind of redefines activism in this country and really internationally with their kind of really confrontational, tactics. And in some ways it's, what Larry Kramer understood was also what Donald Trump understood, which was, you know, the whole game here was to get the public's attention, however possible. And so, you know, that is what he did with the most kind of over the top protests that they could organize. And so I think that, you know, what the activism that was so powerful in the city during these years kind of speaks to, you know, what I referred to before as the kind of birth of a modern city, that there's a sort of a struggle going on here for the identity of New York. And, that struggle that, you know, there are different sides, you know, to Al Sharpton, there was, the city was, you know, irredeemably racist. The criminal justice system was racist. The black people were being, left out of the economic transformation of the city. He was, you know, he was responding to this historical moment with his kind of activism. And Larry Kramer felt that, that the city, and Ed Koch were ignoring this epidemic that was decimating the gay population in New York. And, you know, he too was kind of forged in this moment. So to me, this kind of struggle over what New York was going to become and the ultimate kind of birth of the modern city that came out of that struggle, was a sort of a fertile place for activism because the city was in a sense kind of up for grabs. It was in play.
Well, Ronald Reagan and the whole kind of economic boom that you discuss, I mean, how do you personally feel about that particular economic decision? I mean, when America kind of switched from, I mean, the FDR ideal to the Ronald Reagan ideal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we've seen that it has not been terribly successful. I mean, it has left us both a legacy of unaffordability in New York City, but I mean, you could also say the political legacy that produced Donald Trump was really began with the policies of Ronald Reagan, began with what we now call neoliberalism, the idea of prioritizing globalization, global trade, deregulating markets, which enabled people who work on Wall Street or have money to invest to build huge fortunes quickly, and left a lot of people out. That is, you know, I think that the legacy of all of that is not great. And we are now seeing, we've been seeing a backlash against it really from the rise of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, right up to now in New York, to the rise of Zoran Mamdani. I will say, though, that, you know, if you go back in time and look at where New York was in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected, the city really had no economy to speak of. The manufacturing jobs were gone. The shipping industry was dead. So, you know, the idea that New York needed to somehow reinvent itself, somehow had to make itself a more hospitable place for businesses, somehow had to better leverage its real estate to create tax revenues. That isn't, you know, the whole thing wasn't kind of born in sin. Like those were healthy and necessary impulses. I think the problem is it was all just too unconstrained. It was too unregulated, and things just quickly kind of spiraled out of control. And the business community in New York and the real estate community in New York developed an enormous amount of political power because they had so much leverage in the new city. And you know, a lot of people ended up losing out.
Well, the homeless issue is prominent in your book as well, and I think there were changes. I don't know. I'm sure you know a whole lot more about it. But the changes in the laws that allowed any kind of mental institutions to empty themselves and put these people out on the street. And I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. And your book kind of doesn't let me know either, because you have a complex character who was trying to avoid being committed. So how did this? The homeless crisis has not gotten any better.
Yeah, it hasn't. I mean, it was incredible. I just in the Times yesterday, we had a story that reported that last year there were 154,000 homeless children in the New York City public school system. Wow. 154,000 homeless children. That is like much larger than the school district in most American cities. I mean, it's an incredible statistic. It hasn't gotten any better, and it's gotten a lot worse. And, you know, the roots of it really are in these years or the years just preceding them. You know, they can be traced back to two kind of main things. One is, as you mentioned, the closure of state psychiatric hospitals, which was a kind of a national phenomenon, but in New York, New York closed state psychiatric hospitals that had hundreds of thousands of patients in them who the idea was that you know, at the time, this was the time of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This was the time when new psychotic drugs were being created, when psychiatric drugs were being created, when it was there was kind of a revolution happening in terms of like the treatment of the mentally ill. And it was thought that these institutions were inhumane and there's no reason to say that all evidence suggests that they were. Yeah. And there was supposed to be a plan. These people were supposed to end up in kind of community centers, kind of halfway houses. There was going to be funding for it where they would go, and they would gradually reassimilate into society. The problem was none of those halfway houses were ever built. And instead, people were just kind of released en masse from these hospitals. And they, you know, were people who were suddenly no longer required to take their medication and often didn't want to. And they had no means and they had no place to live. So they ended up on the streets of New York, many of them. That's one part of the root of the homelessness crisis. The other is that during this period of time, this period of rebirth for New York, what one of the most kind of important sources of New York's kind of regeneration was the repurposing of cheap housing, of welfare hotels where the poorest New Yorkers could basically just spend their federal benefits on their rent. Those were transformed wholesale across the city, particularly on the Upper West Side, into high-end apartment buildings. Because once real estate developers and landlords and owners could do that, it was vastly more profitable than having tenants paying you, you know, $50 a month from their federal assistance checks, and that sent you know, many, many thousands of more New Yorkers into the streets. So sort of a combination of those two things, which happened really, you know, right around the same time or in rapid succession, that that led to this homelessness crisis that we are still living with, and in many ways is worse than ever because the affordability crisis is worse than ever. Now it's so expensive to live in the city that so many people are homeless, even with jobs. We have working homeless.
Working homeless. That's
yeah.
Well, so that kind of brings us to the mayoral race. I think one thing we've learned from the 2016 and 2024 elections is that debates are completely meaningless because yeah. It doesn't matter how you do in the debate if you're Donald Trump anyway. But yeah. So, but what about the debate that just occurred, and what do you think is the consensus of New Yorkers about the mayoral race?
Yeah, I mean you're right. It really the debate didn't change anyone's mind, it seems like a fait accompli that Zohran Mamdani is going to be the next mayor. I mean, I think that you know, the business community has done everything it can to try to stop him, but mostly that has meant you know, shoveling money into Andrew Cuomo's campaign, but it doesn't seem to be working. It doesn't seem to be enough. And Cuomo's, you know, running a terrible campaign. He's not really making a compelling case to voters. And so it seems like New York has sort of chosen its path, and it's just now a matter of time. I mean, you know, I guess something could change, but I think on the betting site, you know, Polymarket, it's like he has like a 90% chance of winning at this point.
Well, when Mayor Koch was elected and then elected, mm-hmm. You know, each time there was a certain amount of high hopes for him to accomplish his goals, just as there will be in this next one. So yeah. Will there be the same kind of disappointment and unhappiness? Is that inevitable? I mean, is it possible to?
I mean, I think it's very difficult. The idea that in a sense, I think what has allowed Mamdani to connect with voters here in New York is that he's posing a kind of a new future for New York, a kind of an existential change to the city. He is and that is what has galvanized so many voters. And I think, you know, that is going to be, this is a difficult city to govern. This is a difficult city to make changes in. Even the most ambitious mayors fail more often, much more often than they succeed. And so, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult, particularly given that he's starting with these expectations of really a kind of a revolution. Yeah.
Well, your book covers the years 1986 to 1990, and it makes total sense that it does. But will there be gods of New York too? And do you
we'll have to see. I don't have any plans right now. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens over the next few years. I mean, I will say that you know, one of the reason why I call this book "Gods of New York" is sort of obviously intended to be half ironic. These guys were not gods,
no.
But but they were kind of larger than life. They were big figures in New York, and we don't really have big figures like this, or they don't come along as often. We certainly don't have a lot of them kind of fighting for the city's attention and over the direction of the city as well. But Zohran is, you know, he's a legitimate god of New York. I mean, Andrew Cuomo is not, but Zohran is. I mean, he has really he looms very large in the city right now in a way that you know, we have not seen in a long time.
I have another question for you about New York. So New York is famously the city that doesn't sleep. And I noticed when I've been there in the last couple of years, it sleeps.
I know. Well, I was so shocked a few years ago. It was right after the pandemic when the city was still just kind of opening up, when I found myself kind of in a restaurant at like 10 and it was clear. And this was like in Tribeca. It was sort of clear that they were, really? Place was empty, and they were kind of like picking up our table. Like, could you get out of here? Then I walked to the subway and I was like, it was like dead. Like, yeah. That really is
all those diners that were always open all night are close at nine, and even Chinatown at 10 o'clock is all closed up.
No, it's there are still some neighborhoods where young people go. I will say that, you know, when my kids, who are, you know, both college students, when they are home, they manage to find places to go. don't bring them back to our house until the wee hours of the morning. So clearly there are some places open, but yeah, it's not the same.
Do you think so one of the guys at one of the diners told me that it's because they can't get anybody to work.
I do think that's an issue. That's a big issue. No question. Yeah. Places can't stay open. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. We see places, you know, even places that, you know, used to be open for lunch, can no longer stay open for lunch, or used to be open for dinner, can't stay open for dinner. Yeah.
But if there's a homeless crisis and there are people who need jobs, then why can't they get people to work?
Yeah, I know. It's a good, very good question. I don't know how this is, that it does seem like there's a kind of a management problem here. Yeah. A labor management problem. Yeah.
Well, go over to the New York Times and ask, find out, get back to me. So you don't know what you're going to write next, or you do?
I don't. No, I really don't. I don't. I genuinely don't. Like, I have to. I'm still, you know, as this interview suggests, I'm still publicizing this book. I'm still talking to people about this book. So I'm, and that's going to kind of continue through the end of the year. So, you know, until then, I think anything is, I probably will. You know, plus I have my day job. So
that's right. Well, what are you researching for the New York Times magazine? Or you're not allowed to say?
I'm also in between stories for the magazine. Everything's up in the air
Well, you have free time to promote your book then.
Yes. Well, right. I don't know. It's not so free. I need to be pitching ideas to my editor. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Jonathan Mahler, it's a congratulations, because it is an incredible book, and I think everybody should go out and get it. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of what it's all about here in this conversation. The book is called The Gods of New York, Egotists, Idealists, Opportunists, and the Birth of the Modern City, 1986 to 1990. And the author, Jonathan Mahler, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me, Gary. It was a pleasure.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the president and founder of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She teaches at Emerson College in Boston, and she's active on Twitter at Lissa_Warren. And she joins me here often on From the Bookshelf. Lissa Warren, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
Lissa, what are you reading?
I'm reading Medication, Mental Illness, and Murder: What Really Killed the Crespi Twins by Edward L. Jones III, and published by Roman and Littlefield, and it just came out. It is the true story of a terrible family tragedy, and it's a tragedy that is made all the more terrible by how absolutely preventable it was. Here's the story. David Crespi was a really good father, totally loving guy, gentle giant of a man, a star in the world of finance, and he had 5 healthy, happy children. And his wife, Kim, never suspected that the life that they had built together so carefully would be destroyed in less than 40 minutes. In January of 2006, she went to get a haircut, and while she was gone, David, her husband, murdered their twin daughters, who were 5 years old at the time. Their names were Tisara and Samantha, and I think it's important to mention their names. He killed them during a game of hide-and-seek, and in the aftermath, family and friends and even David Crespi himself had more questions than answers. In this book, Medication, Mental Illness, and Murder, Ed Jones chronicles David Crespi's struggle with insomnia and depression, and he looks at the role that SSRI antidepressants may have played in the killings. And he also kind of chronicles the wife Kim's, the mother Kim's, unimaginable journey of trauma and suffering and eventually forgiveness. And he had full access to her journal entries. So it is, you know, reporting like directly from the source in that way. He also talked with a lot of doctors, psychologists, people who were experts on depression, and also he takes us inside North Carolina's penal and mental health systems, because this took place in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he looks at Big Pharma. So he kind of takes what happened in all angles, like approaches it in every way you possibly could to try to understand how something like this could take place and whether other people who are on SSRI antidepressants are at risk of harming themselves or harming someone they love. It is a hard book to read, but it is beautifully crafted and impeccably researched, and it's a really important topic. So I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Well, it sounds fascinating and sad, but of course I want to ask a couple of questions. So I'm sure some people would think, and maybe this is what happens in the court case that followed, that, you know, he committed this murder because he wanted to and is using drugs as an excuse for what he did.
That is how some people will view this, but Ed Jones feels the exact opposite, that David Crespi was devastated and horrified by what he had done to these two little girls who he absolutely adored. And you will not find a person, and David Crespi, you know, couldn't give you any names and wouldn't say anybody had said anything bad about him ever, but Ed Jones checked it out. And there was no bad stuff on this guy. Like, he really was an amazing father. There were no red flags. There was no record of child abuse. None of that. No signs, no flags. So it didn't seem to Ed Jones that David Crespi had done anything intentionally to his children and then used his depression and these drugs as a cover-up. David Crespi seemed more perplexed than anyone about how something like this could have happened, how he could have done something like this, and he takes full responsibility for it. He's not saying, I didn't do it. He knows he did it. He actually called the police and turned himself in immediately after he did this to them.
Wow.
So, just tragic. And he's, you know, in prison for life and having a very rough time of it from what Ed Jones reports.
Now, and Edward L. Jones III, can you tell us a little bit about him? Who is he?
Yeah, sure. He comes from the advertising world, actually. He was a writer in advertising and higher education. So, you know, unrelated to writing books and unrelated to, you know, the topic of depression. He's not a psychologist. He's not coming at it from that angle at all. He came to it as an investigative journalist because he also has been a columnist for the Charlotte Observer for a number of years. And of course, as I said, this took place in North Carolina. So he, you know, he sort of lived this with the community, with the town when it happened. And he just researched the heck out of it and got access to the journals of Kim Crespi, as I said, but also had access to David Crespi, interviewed him for the book. This is his first book. This is Ed Jones's first book, but he does a bang-up job of it.
Medication, Mental Illness, and Murder, What Really Killed the Crespi Twins, by Edward L. Jones III. Lissa Warren, thanks for bringing that one to our attention. Sounds like a good but sad read.
It is both of those things and important as well.
Well, thank you, and thanks for being with us on From the Bookshelf. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.